Hello and welcome to the Professional Insight Podcast, Season 6. We still don't know the episodes, but no one really cares.
I care.
My name is Brandon Curry, and where's everybody else? Ah, there we are.
I care which episode. I'm Jeff Collins.
I'm Josh Bond.
I'm Trevor Lindy.
And our special guest today, a huge friend of the show, huge fan of the show, just, you know, I'm sure, writes in all the time. The legendary Charles Adler. How are you, Mr. Adler?
Big fan of the show, and I happen to know because I'm a big fan that this is episode 4,294.
Nice.
By the way, I love your intro. There you go, John. I love the intro of the show. I love Chris Rook, of course. I'm sure Chris Rook produced it. It feels like Mad Men that I'm coming on, which is one of my favorite all-time series.
Mad Men, yeah.
Love Mad Men. Love it. Love the
one of the offices in our office has a little benumb, a 6 foot man sitting in the corner, a couple cigar boxes. You want to talk about Mad Men?
I've never done that series yet. And like my wife's into Suits right now. I think that might be the next one.
Suits is good, but there's more liquor in Mad Men.
Well, there you go. I'll have to watch that. It's based back in time though, right?
Yeah. 50s and 60s of the advertising industry. And it makes you want to drink a Manhattan or two. During each episode,
I just can't believe they were able to accomplish anything. I mean, sometimes it feels like it's not just a liquid lunch, but liquid breakfast, a liquid dinner, a liquid coffee break. I mean, they're just drinking all the time.
I imagine there's a little bit of sexual harassment in it. Back in the 50s, a little bit.
The show is not HR friendly.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
So I've got just a little bit brief. I mean, if you even need an introduction, Mr. Adler, but I mean, obviously,
I do need one today because I've got a touch of the flu, so I don't know who I am. So I really appreciate the intro.
You grew up in Montreal, but you are a Hungarian Canadian. You immigrated here. I don't know what age did you immigrate here?
I was only 2 and a half, so the Hungarian thing is a bit of a footnote. I know most about Hungary from my parents. Many of their experiences, anyone who reads about my history, will know that many of their experiences were negative. So I am called a Hungarian Canadian because I guess that's what I officially would be, but I just think of myself as a Canadian.
Now we might have to cut the show early if you're from Montreal and you cheer for the Habs.
Well, I did cheer for the Habs for a number of years, and then there was what do they say in the crime world when the statute of limitations? So statute of limitations kicked in. It was easy for the statute of limitations to kick in because the Habs that we've had for the last 20 years are absolutely nothing like the Yvon Cornway and Jean Béliveau and Guy Lafleur Habs that I cheered for. So I cheer for the Jets because. Winnipeg has become my adopted home. Winnipeggers have been very, very good to me. And the Jets are religion out here, the Jets and the Bombers. So those are the guys I cheer for.
Absolutely. You're about to go through a rebuild then, it looks like, eh? So that'll be interesting, the Jets.
I just want to point out that Charles said the Habs are nothing like they used to be, but we can all say the Leafs are like they always have been.
The Leafs are very traditional.
Exactly.
I got to tell you that my animus toward the Leafs does have a lot to do with Montreal. While the Canadians are religion in Montreal, part of that religion is kind of, it's catechism, if you will, to hate the Toronto Maple Leafs. So every year that the pundits say that the Leafs are just, you know, an inch away, I'm thinking, you know, it's like for a lot of guys, you know, maybe 1 inch for them, but it's a foot for someone else. I do admire some members of the Leafs. I only admire them to a certain extent because I tend to admire most the guys who play really, really well when the money's on the table. When the money's on the table for the Toronto Maple Leafs, they're not close to the table.
No, they're not even close.
They push away.
But no, see, you know, if you want to talk Leafs for a moment, you know, there is you know, injustice there as there is for the Blue Jays this year. Blue Jays have a real, you know, solid talent.
Well, like,
but they're, as Buck Martinez confirmed the other night, you know, the Blue Jays are not a playoff team. The Maple Leafs at least do make, you know, the first round, But when you think about the incredible talented players on the Maple Leafs, you know, you have to ask yourself some serious questions. It really bothers me when you've got a payroll that is that just. I mean, I would say that, you know, if I have to compare the Leafs to Stanley Cup winners over the years, the present version of the Leafs is as good on paper as any of them. You know, I'll invoke the goalie notwithstanding clause, but the Maple Leafs should be doing. They're underachieving. There's no nice.
Yeah, but you got to agree they were missing some piss and vinegar and snot, and it looks like the new GM has kind of recognized that. So we'll.
Yeah, well, we'll see how this
year goes.
They always are, and I keep hearing. And I lived in Toronto several times, because of course you need to go to Toronto to get the best offers in the country. You got to say I worked at CFRB anyway. You know, so I've done the Toronto.
Put it on the resume.
I've done the Toronto ticket 4 or 5 times now, and it's true that the only reason I end up going to Toronto from time to time is business. And most people are in Toronto. Most people who, you know, haven't lived in Toronto all their lives live there because that's their way of dealing with the affordability crisis. But the idea that that all of the people who make excuses for the Maple Leafs say that they're under more pressure because they're working in Toronto and they're working in a very, very difficult media environment, et cetera, that is the biggest load of crap that gets emitted in Canada frequently. It is not true that it is more difficult for a person to be a hockey player in Toronto than it is in Winnipeg or Vancouver or anywhere else. That's just nonsense. First of all, most people in every market in Canada right now are the majority, especially the majority of new Canadians, are not huge fans of the National Hockey League. They come from most of them come from places where soccer is the national religion, not hockey. Hockey's not even close. But beyond that, in most markets, to the extent that people know the players on any of these teams, they only know some of them. I mean, I don't doubt that there may be a million people in the greater Toronto area who can recognize 2 or 3 of the superstars of the Maple Leafs if they just saw them in their street clothes. But the idea that everyone who wears a Leafs jersey is being stalked constantly by people and by media, that's nonsense.
That's bullshit, for sure. For sure.
You can go back to introducing 4 to 5. 4 to 5. You can go back to introducing now because I'm once again starting to forget.
No problem. Anytime. Now, we did – you actually just touched on something because, you know, I do watch your – 3 minutes that matter. You do that. And then, I've watched a bunch of your shows. Obviously I was a fan prior to you joining this network. We are, aligned in a lot of ways, which is great. I mean, obviously, the political climate now is not what the political climate was when you were in your heyday on CFRB and on all your shows. It's just so divisive now. And I just, I guess it's frustrating. So I'm a certified financial planner. And then obviously you've got Jeff is a realtor and a builder. Trevor is a mortgage broker and Josh, a real estate lawyer, Will's power of attorney, et cetera. And
semi-retired.
You know, there's a clip.
We have no public sector people here. We have no.
No, they're gainfully employed. Actually,
I've never been in a show. I've done 10,000 shows. I've never done a show with nothing but private sector people. It's a pleasure.
Private sector self-employed. Thank you. Thanks for coming on. the jobs data came out, when was it, like for August? And I think, private sector went down 22%, public sector went up. So that was really good. I'd like to show you a little clip. And it just didn't, it pulls at my heartstrings, to put context to everything here. I am, if I were to lean anywhere, I'd lean capitalist more than anything, on most things, except when something happens to an individual that nothing, they did not do anything, i.e. COVID-19 shuts down the Niagara Casino and they're all put on CERB. Which is $2,000 a month, as opposed to what they're used to, which is $70,000 or $80,000 a year. People lost some houses and stuff like that down here in Niagara. But this, if we can show it, and then I just like to, I want your opinion and your insight on just the political discourse that's going on right now and how the average person is getting screwed. Rookie, can you tee that up, please? That'd be great.
Everybody keeps saying it's going to get better. How is it going to get better? Our economy is so fucked that I work a full-time job. I make $21 an hour working 40 hours a week. I have no extra expenses, no bills out of my living. I have one credit card that's max because I've lived off of it. But other than that, I don't have cable. I haven't had cable in 10 years. We have cell phones, but, you know, that's required to live on. But other than that, nothing extra. On paper, my bills are $2,701. My income is $2,710. Do the math. $9 a month before I pay for food, gas, car repairs, any entertainment. There's no money for that. And my car is dying. It's paid for, so I don't have car payments now that I'm going to replace. And I don't know how to do that on $9 a month. $9 to feed myself, $9 to buy a car, $9 for insurance. Yeah.
You cut that short. My wife
sent me that. Yeah, my wife sent me that that clip, and you know, my wife's a psychotherapist up at Toronto there, a couple hospital network there, and you know, obviously with what I do for a living, I'm the one that does the cash flow statements. I'm the one that does, you know, for our family, and that's fine. It just is, that's just what my passion is. But the political discourse right now. And regardless of politics or the parties per se, it's just disgusting that someone who makes $40,000-$50,000 a year, and in a lot of cases higher, can't make ends meet. And a lot of this, in my personal opinion, is because of stupid decisions that bureaucrats and politicians made at all levels of government and from all parties. And they don't care. Like in Niagara, I just added, and the guys know this, because of the municipalities, our property taxes went through the bloody roof. So I'd like to, like, you do address some of this on your show, but I think sometimes it just gets lost onto, like, why can't I criticize the current prime minister regardless of the fact of what parties want? Or why can't I criticize our current premier in Ontario or your premier in Manitoba, regardless of the party that they're from? Like, can you've lived, and I don't mean this to be facetious, I mean, you've seen a lot more than we have. And I'd like to have your insight. Like, what the hell is going on? Because you've seen the 70s, the Volcker, right? And rate hikes and stuff. So go ahead.
By the way, I've got the flu. I wasn't sickened by what I heard physically, but I was sickened by it mentally. You know, when I see someone who is clearly working hard and clearly being very honest about what she has and what she doesn't have, and I'm thinking in my brain that the only way that she can escalate her standard of living, the only way that she can get stress out of her life to some extent, is to move to a country where no one speaks English. You know, that's a sad, sad picture of Canada. And while the chattering classes aren't involved with these kinds of conversations, because they're talking about, you know, whether or not the education system is a sex Godzilla, grooming and invading their children. Well, that is taking up, you know, thousands of yards of airtime. This is the story. This woman in Niagara is the story. And Pierre Poilievre may say that, you know, she lives in a shack, and then that becomes the controversy. Well, the controversy isn't about whether or not she lives in what Pierre Poilievre calls a shack. The controversy is simply this. Is our country for everybody or for just 60%? Because she represents at least 40% of the country right now. They're different. We have different labels, you know, working poor, working class, but it doesn't matter what the labels are. She's one of the many people who can't even afford cable. Not that cable is cheap. That's a whole other story. But the point is that what most of us throughout most of our lives consider the basics, and I'll just put it in the starkest terms possible, because that's what I guess I'm known for. That's one reason I've been invited to this excellent podcast. So in stark terms, if this was the Canada that my parents arrived in and worked factory labor for minimum wage, their little boy probably would have become a thief, because I would have done anything to keep a roof over our heads and anything for food. And I would have paid attention to my role models on the street who might have been thieving, whether they were thieving, you know, cigarettes or other things. That's probably the life that I would have been motivated to pick up on, because most companies won't hire a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old. And so when we ask ourselves the question, you know, why are so many people involved in crime? Well, this story is one of the reasons that people are involved in crime. They don't feel that they can make it. They don't feel that they can have a good life, you know, working honest labor like this woman in Niagara. And I can preach family values until the cows come home and good role modeling. And I can say that economics has nothing to do with crime, but that's baloney. That's always been baloney. You know, people are motivated to do the wrong things when they get punished for doing the right things. That woman is being punished for doing the right thing, and that woman represents multiple millions of Canadians who are virtually invisible. The politicians who are involved in culture wars and other wars discussing things that are absolutely irrelevant to her life.
I think there was an expletive at the end of it. That's why I had said cut short a bit against, if I'm not mistaken, right? Against one of
F Ontario, pretty much, which don't get me wrong. It like, but I guess like it's a culmination of a lot of bad policies, decisions. And I just find, I agree with you. Like what are we doing when the topic of conversation is, you know, what my kids are learning in school? Okay, sure. But how about focusing on the things that actually matter? You know, all levels of government, again, certified financial planner, I'm all about having a plan. Politicians aren't. They're worried about getting to the next election cycle. You guys are worried about getting reelected and whatever it takes to get reelected.
And what is that though, Brandon, right? It's a lot of times targeting the people that they think are going to go out and vote, right? And who Absolutely. Are those people? Are they the people that, you know, the class that this lady falls into? I don't know, right? And I think they target the higher social economic status individuals, right? And I think that might be part of our problem, right? Like that their target audience is off, right?
We can talk about politics and conservatives versus liberals and NDP and all that kind of stuff. And I'm okay with that. I frankly can do that in my sleep.
I like your centralist view, though.
Well, it's just so much of this has nothing to do with the current political agendas of the political parties. Because, you know, you guys are all involved in business. Talk to anyone who's developing an apartment building or a subdivision of single-family homes and ask them about their expenses. Ask them. And are they all about politics? Well, sure. There's a certain input that's taxes. There's a certain input that's regulations. But so much of what the supply chain is all about and supply chain inflation in the last couple of years, which gets passed on, and it doesn't matter whether it gets passed on to people of the upper income level or the middle level or the lower level. The point is that our economy right now, the last couple of years, especially since COVID, is dealing with a lot of supply chain inflation. And you can talk about the price of paint. You can go to the food store, talk about the price of grapes. The point is we're dealing with significant inflation. And it doesn't matter to me how often the government people and economists come in with, well, you know, if you leave out fuel and if you leave out food and if you leave out paint and if you leave out everything else that you buy at Home Depot, if you leave all of that out, inflation's not that bad. Well, you know, when you're hearing that kind of conversation, what are you really hearing? Are you hearing anything that relates to the woman making $40,000 or the guy making, man or female making $140,000? That's an irrelevant conversation. The price of everything is significantly higher, and naturally it pinches those most who are at the lower level. So, you know, let's talk about Godzilla and trans kids, because that's a whole lot easier than this stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the thing is because the devil is in the details and nobody knows or cares about the details. They like, I'll give you an example. The announcement that happened. So for anyone that, you know, like is watching this later on, this is Friday, September the 15th, when this episode's going live. If people are downloading that, our loyal fans. Yesterday on two different levels, we get an announcement on they're waiving the GST on new rental housing. Okay, good. That's a good step, but that doesn't make housing affordable. We need to get people out of into housing. You know, then there's the, you know, affordable housing. We're going to affordable housing. There's, you know, lower down the prices of groceries or we're going to tax you. It's like, well, taxes will just get passed on to the end consumer. But then you've got all the social wars that are going on with the official opposition. It's like none of it. Nobody wants to talk about what actually is happening to the people. And what I'm finding with my anecdotally, but to a lot of financial planners that I talk to, that gap of people that are finding it tough has widened to the, like, I've got people, clients, myself even included, where, you know, you're making, you know, well over six figures. And that's not enough to survive anymore. And you're sitting here going, and you make too much to make any government subsidies or any government relief whatsoever. And you don't make enough to the point where taxes over six figures is at a 47% federal and provincial combined in the province of Ontario, where you're losing 47 cents on every dollar and you can't keep up with inflation. And I just am very I don't know what to say. Like, I'm disheartened.
Well, see, I find it, if you go back a bit, like it seems like the flavor of the moment right now is the housing affordability. Like that's the every topic is about that. And so yesterday's announcement where they're trying to help with affordable housing, I think is redundant. And the ignorance from the municipality levels, because like recently when Charles was talking about developers and all that, I have a group and we're attempting to develop in Niagara somewhere. And when we had the pre-con meeting, all the people from the municipality came out and said, we'd like you to do affordable housing. We will give you rebates on affordable housing. And they said, if you do detached houses affordable and you can build a brand new house under $450,000 with the land, you'll be available for significant tax credits. And I said, well, we're looking at lots that we're buying at about 300,000. Then when you do a build permit with development fees, you're at 355 and you haven't even broken ground. And then they want the builders or developers to make a penny or to invest in this infrastructure, and they're not going to. And on top of that, when you want to build a subdivision, the municipality is saying, well, you have to do all the infrastructure to connect to this street. You have to add the street and the street allowance. All these are extra costs. And when the when the interest rates are high like they are right now, you see every builder right now saying, whoa, 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 I'm not going to build for a while. We're going to hold back. And now, like the latest announcement, they're saying, well, we're going to come up with some new builder incentives. And why are they going to do that? Because no builders are wanting to build right now. And every year that goes by, they're getting backed up how many houses they need to build. They're in a big problem right now. And I think part of the problem, well, I'm knee deep in it right now, the inefficiencies at every government level when you're trying to build or develop are so poor and so costly. And it just adds on to the cost that when I'm making a house now, the profit margin is eroded so bad that why bother? I'm not going to anymore, right? Like they just don't want to. So now they're in a problem where they want to stimulate affordable housing, but you can't even buy the land and get the permit to break the threshold in order to account for affordable housing, unless it's like a stacked townhouse, which is the new trend everywhere. It's coming to Niagara really fast right now. So they're in a pickle.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things though too, right? I mean, you got to think of the footprint, like the size of our properties, like, I mean,
oh, and they're going like this now too, right?
Which is probably good, Jeff, right? I mean, like most of us live in like 2,000 square foot homes and probably don't use at least 500-600 square feet minimum of it, right? Like, and it's just, a lot of us grew up in 1,000 square foot homes, 1,200 square foot homes. And it just, there's that perpetual cycle up until now where it's bigger, 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 right? So I think part of the solution would be make smaller properties. And that would.
Well, and that's the thing now. It's all condos. It's 6 to 8 story condos going up everywhere now, right?
That's
now,
not for everybody either. I'm not saying that, right? But it's.
Well, that's the solution though.
Well, Charles, what's your opinion on that?
Well, one of my opinions is, homework. It is ridiculous for people representing municipalities who were being discussed just a few moments ago to be offering the kinds of numbers that clearly suggest they have not done their homework. Unless you know what the bills are that the developer has to pay, unless you know that the developer has to pay $300,000, for instance, for the lot, that's one of the numbers that jumped out for me in that conversation. Unless you've done the homework on what the issues are for the developers that you're talking to, don't talk to them. Don't pitch until you know who's up at bat. And, you have these conversations at a macro level everywhere in this country. You know, people representing various governments, various agencies, not to mention all of these people who represent certain think tanks and lobbyists, throwing out all of these numbers without knowing anything about what they're talking about. They throw out numbers that look good to people. Let's just get these builders to build homes for $500,000. Surely they can make a buck. Why are you saying that? Well, $500,000 sounds like real money. Oh, did you know that the builder has to pay $300,000 just for the property? Did you know that the builder has to spend all of the money for the infrastructure, pipes, sewers, important stuff like that, so we're not like what we used to call the so-called third world, so that we have a proper and safe civilization. I mean, if you don't know all of those things, why are you having a conversation with the developer? Unless you're telling me that you're only wanting to have a conversation with the developer so that you can tell people who don't know anything, some of your constituents, that you're busy, that you're doing things, that you care, that you've got compassion. Are you just using the developer as a political prop? And so much of the conversation that goes on with respect to affordability and everything else is simply about messaging, imaging, making sure that people feel that you're doing something. And what's the definition of doing something? Looking like you're doing something. Looking like you're doing something doesn't create affordable housing.
Absolutely. Smoke and mirrors is what they're all about. They're selling smoke and mirrors. That's it.
That's what PP's been doing.
Well, and
he's on the campaign trail and all smoke and mirrors.
It is. But at the end of the day, like Charles,
that's not a fair jab. Because I mean, he's not.
I'll be honest. You want to do that PP though. His new thing that he put out there about giving bonuses to municipalities if they can push through permits or developments quicker. to me is beautiful, because a development where we put in 2 years ago and we gave them the exact concept we want to do, we are no further ahead 2 years after, and they've approved the exact one we started with, and we've incurred $150,000 worth of financing fees. So if they would have put a little bit of a, they don't give a shit, unfortunately, how quick it takes us to get it done, and the carrying costs add up and then gets passed on to the consumer.
Yet. They don't care yet. Eventually, they're going to care.
They'll care a year before the election. That's when they'll care. A year before the election comes up, then all of a sudden, they'll come up with true answers. Right now, it's about pause and delay and all that.
And, you know, you mentioned delay. Far too much money in this country is spent on those two words used, pause and delay. A lot of people don't understand that every time you're asking a developer to delay this and delay that, you know, they've got money in the game. And they've borrowed money to have money in the game. So they've got to pay interest rates. The banker doesn't give a damn whether you're pausing and delaying. The banker just wants the
cash,
wants the big, wants the price of money to be paid. You're paying for that money whether you're able to deploy it or not. And I don't really believe that the various agencies, the various levels of government, are sensitive to that. I mean, we've got, when it comes to, you know, housing affordability, just like the affordability of food, the system that we have, which creates all of these inputs, cost inputs, is brutally inefficient.
Inefficient, well, hugely, is the best word for government right now, especially municipality level. Inefficient, well, and you said it perfectly, they're doing zero homework before they're bringing up these solutions. They're not talking to the end users or the developers or builders and saying, how can we help you? Is there any way we could be more efficient? Is there any way we could support you to reduce your costs so you can reduce your end price so we can increase this? In Niagara right now, I think the biggest problem, and I've talked about this many times in our show, and I agree, if we can make 1,100, 1,200 square foot bungalows, two-bedroom bungalows, that's what's needed out there right now, because there's a ton of empty nesters right now, and they're coming flooding in, and they want to sell off their older house that's a family house, a two-story, because they cannot do the stairs anymore. No, they don't want to live in an apartment building or condo just because they want the privacy still. And I appreciate that. Most of these people have no mortgages. But there is no place around right now that is building 1,200 square foot bungalows, because the builder, in order to make a profit, has to increase the size of his house in order to make it a profit, to make it workable for that. Yep. Right? So when we built in Dane City, and we started about 5 years ago, we built 1,300 square foot bungalows, undetached lots with minimal size frontage, you know, 42 foot frontage. By that, now a typical frontage, you're looking at 25 to 30 foot frontage. And there's only one way you can build that house. It's up.
Oh.
You got to go two story, right?
Yep.
So the bungalows are just not extinct. They're going extinct, brand new bungalows. Nobody's building them at all unless they're on a $1.5 million property.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to say that the only way that you can afford to build bungalows is to charge a ridiculous amount of money per square foot to build it. And the empty nester doesn't want to pay a financial penalty to live in a bungalow. That's not happening. They want to be able to sell their home for a very, very good price compared to what they paid for it at 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And they want to put that money away so that they can live off it. They don't want to take all that money and pump it into a bungalow.
They'd like to buy a bungalow, pocket 400 grand, and then make interest off that 400 grand, which pays for their monthly thing, and they're living free. That's the goal right now. That's
what they all want. And what you're seeing right across the country, and I mentioned earlier that the only way that particular woman could escalate her standard of living significantly is to move to a country where no one speaks English. I wasn't saying that just to be, you know, just to be shocking. It's just that is true. It's what some people have done. They've gone to Eastern Europe and some other parts of the world where they allow some immigration. They can't speak the language. They can't speak English. But they've got that bungalow. Sometimes they even have the bungalow with an ocean view, and they can now have a relatively stress-free life. But here's the point: most people aren't doing that. What many people are doing is they're leaving the Torontos and the Vancouvers and the Montreals and some other cities, and they're going to small towns. Now, there was a time when you could look at something like the Niagara region as a small town, but of course now that's ridiculous. And the Niagara region is a series of very expensive suburbs, not much different than the suburbs that are only 10 miles away from Toronto.
It's becoming a metropolis.
Ontario, they've got to go deeper into the heartland of Ontario. You've got to go to places where relatively few people live, and then you may find that bungalow.
Timmins.
Woo! But the thing too is the other thing as well, and I don't know. I again, and I'm at a loss for what to do. You know, like, and I think the biggest problem is, and if you can give me some insight on this, Charles, that'd be great, because I read or heard somewhere, can't remember, because I try to digest as much as I can, that I think as early as 1968, we were able to impeach politicians, and that got taken off the table, not recall. So there's a difference between recall and impeachment, just so people are understanding. Recall is it like California, where you get a whole bunch of signatures and you just recall and you go to a re-election kind of a deal. But impeachment is when, you know, there's a fireable offense, or there's negligence or gross negligence, kind of like, oh, I don't know, maybe the Greenbelt right now. You know, we don't have that as voters, and we have no recourse to fire these politicians that we may have, you know, some advice or some hesitation. Am I right in that? It was back in the late 1960s. Canada did have that, did it not?
I honestly do not recall. I'm not trying to give you a political response. I don't recall politicians being impeached, but I also don't think that, let's say you could impeach politicians right now, you can impeach some of them for the Greenbelt. Let's go with that. That still is not responsible for most of the problems that we're talking about. We're living in a very thick regulatory environment where everything, you know, we could discover lithium in different parts of Canada. We've got some lithium operations going on in Ontario, Manitoba, and Quebec, and perhaps elsewhere, but those are the only three that I'm specifically aware of. But even though we discover lithium, and we know that lithium is needed for all these batteries that are being made for all of these cars, some of which are being sold, some of which are piling up, putting aside where we are specifically on the e-car trade, there is a growing demand for batteries. We know that. We know that they need lithium. We know that Canada has lithium. Does that mean we're getting the lithium out of the ground tomorrow? Does that mean that the John Deere's are being revved up right now to move land around for lithium mining? Are you kidding me? You know, a news announcement could come out today on a lithium mine exploration that will get underway, but will get underway might mean we'll get underway in a year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years. We don't know, because we live in an extremely inefficient environment where you've got a great thicket of laws and regulations that put everything on the words that you were using a few moments ago, that Jeff was using. It's pause and delay. That's the kind of culture we're living in, pause and delay. If pause and delay was this operational in football, nobody would watch it.
We've gone from shock and awe to pause and delay. That's what's going on.
You bet. I mean, we talk about bringing in 500,000 Canadians a year, 500,000 new people a year. We talk about, at the moment, I think we've got over 800,000 foreign students in this country. So clearly we don't have enough housing for all the people that we've got here, and we certainly don't have nearly enough housing for all the people we're bringing in. And yet there is no pause and delay on that. And one of the reasons there's no pause and delay on that is because if you talk about immigration, you're immediately labeled a racist. And once you're labeled a racist, the conversation ends. Now, anyone listening to this conversation goes, what the hell does racism have to do with the problems that Jeff and Brendan and Chuck and the others are talking about? It has nothing to do with it. I'm simply saying that for people who want the status quo, all they have to do is use a slur, a smear, and the conversation stops. You know, we've got to become a more efficient country. Instead of just discussing what we used to be, I get sick and tired of talking about what we used to be. You know, it was, I guess, the 1970s when I had a professor at McGill who was a visiting professor from Yale, and he was going back to Yale. He wanted to take me with him. So he wanted me involved in the history program at Yale that he was heading up. And he actually got me an admission to Yale. That's golden. Okay. That's platinum. That's as good as it gets. But I couldn't go because while he could get me an admission, he couldn't get me a scholarship. And I'll never forget this, because the professor says to me, look, as long as your dad makes $20,000, we can work out the money. And I just about started sobbing. I said, sir, my dad doesn't make $20,000. And he said, well, how close is he? I said, well, he isn't even halfway there. And he couldn't imagine. You know, he was a relatively rich guy from Connecticut, you know, where Yale is located. He was a rich Yankee, as they used to call him, a rich New Englander. And he couldn't conceive that any human being anywhere in the English-speaking world was making less than $10,000. So that's the used-to-be world. And I did whatever I could, just as other people did whatever they could, to give themselves a position in life where if they had a son or a daughter who was able to attend an Ivy League school, they could pay for that. Well, once again, that's used-to-be. Today, there are people who make $250,000 who still can't afford to send their kid to an Ivy League school. Now, some people sit here and go, well, what does that really matter? Well, it's just a story. Well, it's just a true story. And the true story is that in this country, where we've told ourselves for years that as long as you're making six figures, you can get by, now we're being told that people who make six figures are feeling poor. Certainly, they're feeling stressed. You know, people talk about poverty and they say, well, we don't know what poverty is because we should take a look at what countries in the developing world are doing. That doesn't matter. That's just academic. That's just theoretical. We live in the real world. And the real world that we grew up in, anybody that could hit six figures was hitting the jackpot. Saying yep. that today, yep. just tell a millennial today that hitting six figures, hitting the jackpot. He'll want to hit you in the face.
Now, have we become too spoiled as a society with our pleasantries and our way of life? Like, and again, I'm just throwing this out here, right? Because a lot of us live with two cell phones. These fucking things are $1,000 a piece now, just for the phone, never mind the plan. Like, so whereas our old phone used to cost, you know, $20 a month, right? Like, kind of deal. Well, and
yeah, but everything, there's, if you go back to that video, there's nothing in that video that she said, okay, that if she's sitting across the table from me as a client, there's nothing that she's doing wrong that I looked at that and went, now, could she have made some bad financial decisions, you know, earlier in life that could have put her behind the eight ball before she started? Possibly. But everything that she's told, like everything that she said she's cut would be the things that I would ask, you know, no, do you really need cable? The answer is no, you don't. Mm-hmm. You don't need cable. But you need a cell phone if you don't have cable, because you need a hotspot somehow. You need to be able to get internet access somehow. She doesn't have a car payment, right? And her car's about to break down, right? Like, it's, you know, is...
Now, I wonder, is she someone who just had the interest rate go up, and that's why she can't afford it, or has it been going like that for a while?
Oh, it's odds are, for sure.
She's a renter.
But look at her parents, Brandon, in terms of what they lived with, right? They lived with a lot less than what the average person today lives with, right? And I'm just playing advocate here, right? Obviously, I'm just saying, like, you know, is there something that we've kind of, as a society, have contributed to our current kind of?
They're definitely social media has exacerbated the keeping up with the Joneses mentality 100%. That definitely exists. The Trevor sees it when he sees a millennial coming in going, I want to live in this suburb, just like where my parent, like the very, very much like, I want to start off with where my parents left off. That is definitely a situation. But when you do peel back the, you know, the onion, the core of it all, a lot of people, it's death by a thousand cuts. And a lot of those cuts, they can't even escape. I'll give you an example. I can tell you unequivocally, when I look at people, hey, can you show me your cash flow statement? They look at me like like a deer in a headlights. They've got no idea what I'm talking about. So I'm a guy that has a fairly detailed cash flow statement. My wife wants to tear out her eyeballs all the time, but it is what it is. And I literally get a letter from, I get three emails from my municipality. I was telling Trevor this yesterday. And I pay my property taxes monthly. And no word of a lie, coming out next month with 20 days notice, I'm getting an extra $400 taken out because of an impact reassessment.
Oh, so you guys have been reassessed in St. Catharines now?
No, just based on the permit that I used over COVID.
But I thought the taxes have gone up, though.
They have 10.5%.
Yeah, that's from an MPAC assessment, though, right?
No. MPAC has not happened since January of 2016.
Yeah, and that's a big problem coming. That's going to be a big problem.
This is a permit issue. I issued the permit, right? And because of the rentals that I did in my backyard. And I said to the lady that I got at City Hall, I said, do you understand that 55% of Canadians are about $250 away every single month from an unexpected expense to going into bankruptcy? And I go, you're giving me 20 days notice that an extra $420 is coming out of my account? I'm lucky. I have savings. But this is the type of stuff that happens to people that they don't budget for. And there's your problem.
Well, the problem is, Trevor's mentioned it lately. I think you gave me a couple examples, and I won't say any names. I don't know the names anyways. But 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds who had mortgages and all that,
yeah,
you know, they still have a mortgage, which to me, you know, like it's tough, but they do have it, right? Because they've had life expenses and all that. And this interest rate that's coming up right now, like the stories that are about to come out are going to be heartbreaking for some elderly people who got by with almost no mortgage. And all of a sudden they're incurring an extra $300, $500, $700 a month. Right. So like, that's going to be, it's going to get ugly.
Well, I know, Charles, I know you have like, you have a limited time. So I'll let you take, I don't want to chew up too much of your time because I really
give us 3 minutes times three. Be perfect.
So what, any, I don't know. I guess maybe we could be,
I'd like to hear, Charles, what do you think is going to happen the next year in Canada?
Yeah.
Where's it going to go?
Where are they moving this puck? Where are they moving the puck?
How are the smoke and mirrors going to come out?
I don't believe the government can make a significant difference in terms of housing affordability. The only way they could would be to borrow many, many more billions of dollars and increase the debt to create a parallel market. So yeah, if you spent billions of dollars on, let's just call it co-op housing, off-market housing, create a separate market where you buy a home, you buy one of these co-op homes, but you can't ever put it on MLS and get 10% more, 15% more. They will only go up at, you know, 2 or 3% a year. If you were to create that kind of market, you'd have to spend, as I say, you'd have to borrow many billions of dollars to do it. I just don't think the government will do that. So I don't think the government can make a significant impact on housing. And I really don't believe the government can make a significant impact on food. So is this issue going away anytime soon? I don't think so. And I'd love to be wrong.
Yeah.
Now, do you think there's a prospect that...
I feel the same way.
Yeah. Do you think there's a prospect that we're going to start seeing the interest rates tip a little bit within the next quarter? Well,
I think the interest rates are bound to come down for the worst of reasons. The economy will be slowing down. We might even have a technical recession or a real recession. Recession being defined as two quarters of negative growth, that still is possible. And there's no way they can keep interest rates at 5% and 6% when the economy is not even growing or even in decline by 1 or 2%. So that's just that's history and that's math. And that's the way it is. Now, you know, where we go politically, I don't know. Whenever people tell me about polls that are polling something that is 2 years away, it means nothing. Yes, polling is an accurate snapshot. At the moment, the conservatives are significantly ahead of the liberals. The problem I have beyond the polling is I don't see any ideas coming from the conservatives that are going to solve these major problems of ours. I mean, the major problem of all problems in our society is the inefficiency of our supply chain. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about food, transportation, housing, you name it. Everything that is costing us money is costing us much more money because of inefficiency. And the only way that changes is to have an extremely fiscally responsible government. I don't see extreme fiscal responsibility coming out of any of these political parties. And that I have to say, that includes the Conservative Party. If anyone wants to say to me that the Federal Conservative Party or Doug Ford's Conservative Party is extremely fiscally responsible, I mean, sorry, that's a laugher. It's just not the case. And the reason these parties aren't being extremely fiscally responsible is because they don't think that you can win politically. You know, they just don't believe it. There are too many interest groups that want money, too many interest groups that want money spent on obviously their particular selfish interests. That's what they're about, and it's a democracy, so that's fine. And people should be willing to advocate for whatever it is they're advocating for. But so many interest groups over the years, and so many interest groups that have been craving regulation and taxation, have been winning their arguments, because they've been winning their arguments by going to the public and having the public sold on the idea that their particular cause was worth spending money on. Now we've got a system where we can't even afford the basics because of all the money that's spent.
I think one of the biggest problems right now is we're allowing 500,000 new Canadians coming in the country every year, and we're ignoring triple that every year, you know, with the changes. So,
well, you know, one of the problems, that whole argument about people coming in, I mean, you hear this all the time. Well, we have to bring these people in because who's going to build the homes? Mm-hmm. And, you know, this idea that you can't find a way to recruit people in this country to work in the trades, it's the most ridiculous argument I have ever heard in my life.
Absurd.
We've got parents who are worried that their kids getting their arts degrees aren't going to be able to make six figures or seven figures. Duh. Well, encourage them to go to the trades. Encourage the kids themselves. And how do you do that? You show them the money.
Yep.
And I'm sorry, the average person who's going to get a, you know, C grades, you know, 2.5 GPA, working for an arts degree, is not going to make nearly as much as that same young person who can work in the trades. And yeah. I just think this idea that the trades are still stigmatized, or they should be stigmatized, is crazy. And if it means that we've got to put some trade schools into universities so that we can call it a university education, that's fine with me. But this idea that you've got to bring in millions of people into a country where you have no houses for them and make houses more expensive for everyone else because we're stigmatizing the trades, I mean, that's insane.
See, Charles, right now, my best friend's son, he's 18. Instead of going to college, he became a carpenter and an apprentice under my partner. And now he's a carpenter full time at 18 years old. And it's great for him, right? Because 5 years from now, he'll be a master carpenter and he'll be able to build a house. You know, at 23 years old, he'll be able to build a house and be, you know, very substantially supporting himself and everything like that. And I find it encouraging because, like you said, and no offense to people get an arts degree and all that, but you're hoping there where when you have a shortage of houses, what are you going to need? You're going to need tradespeople to build this.
There is an offense to somebody who, too many people going in and getting an arts degree because they don't know what the hell that they want. They go to university. Somebody's told them, listen, you got to go to university. You got to go to university. You can't go to college, right?
And you can't be a tradesperson. You can't be an apprentice.
You just wipe your ass with an arts degree nowadays for the most part, unless you have intentions on
an arts degree. For the most part, an arts degree is the equivalent of what high school was when we were growing up. So this idea of telling people that you have to get an arts degree, sorry, that's really stupid advice. You don't have to have an arts degree.
But this is the weird thing about today's day and age, though. You see, and this is the scary part for the kids. They're all on YouTube. They're not really watching podcasts, but they're on YouTube.
Right.
And they're watching these kids who have no degrees or anything like that, and they're millionaires. I don't know if it's smoke and mirrors and showing that, but the amount of viewers they have or followers they have or subscribers they have, and they're doing nothing but being a jackass on YouTube, and they're becoming millionaires, you know, making more money than doctors and lawyers and whatever you want out there, right?
But listen, my sister's a doctor, very intelligent girl. Her husband's a tradesman. Her two oldest boys, the only ones that have gotten to that level, one's an electrician, the other one's HVAC.
So one comment I'll
make. Good parenting, in my opinion, right?
We're talking about apprenticeships. There needs to be apprenticeship reform, period.
Yeah, 100%. Because carpenters is one-to-one.
Ridiculous.
If you got a carpenter who's been there for 20 years, he can do 5 to 10 apprentices under him.
Here's the reality, though. What trade isn't one-to-one? Electrician is one-to-one. Plumber is one-to-one. I can't think of any.
Carpenter
is one-to-one.
I think the winning message, though, because we can talk, we can get into the entrails of what we're dealing with here with the ratios, and it's an important conversation. But if you're asking me on this show to, you know, give you the big picture stuff, the big picture stuff is this. The message has to change on why you get involved in the trades. You don't get involved in the trades so that you can work a hammer or a drill for the rest of your life. You get involved in the trades so that you can get some knowledge about the trades, and eventually you'll be able to have your own business. You'll be able to be an entrepreneur. There's nothing wrong with working with your hands. There's nothing wrong with being able to hire people who work with their hands. There's nothing wrong with financial independence. There's nothing wrong with all of these things that I can guarantee you will have access to. And I can't give you the same guarantee with a Mickey Mouse arts degree. Can't do it.
And on that note, Mr. Adler, I'm very respectful of your time.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Could you come on again?
Sure.
We'd love to have you.
I'm the son of a tailor. My father,
the Leafs win the cup.
My father, a great tradesman, and my mom also a tradesperson, taught me to never say no to honest people, especially honest people who are involved in the private sector, in the real world. Private sector people who have no safety net, have no cushion, have got to work with their wits and their hands.
Let's be honest, though. Let's not wait until the Leafs win the cup to have Charles back on. Just saying.
It's just going to be in the fall, in the spring.
Another 22 years, I think.
When's the Stanley Cup final now? Like July 22nd or something?
Why don't you agree to invite me once a quarter? How's that?
We would love to have you once a quarter. And if ever you have a topic that comes up on your show that you need any insight on, by all means, reach out to us. We'd love to pop on and give you any insight to help maybe guide your listeners.
I'll be happy to come on.
When I decide to have intelligent private sector people on with experience in the real world, I'll let you know.
Thanks a million, Charles.
Thanks for coming on, Charles.
Appreciate it. And I think you lend a hand that you're referred to as Chuck.
I'm open, I
hope you get better, Charles. Get some rest and some hydration. You'll get better. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lots of stuff we can continue on there, though. I like that.
Well, good point, though, with the arts degree, right? Like, I mean, it's been like that for a little bit now. And I'm not poo-pooing an arts degree. Like, you know what I mean?
But this is the weird part, though. Like, these kids with art degrees can go into making TikTok videos and all kinds of crazy shit like that, and they're banking $1 million a year in certain places in the States.
That's not the norm. And like we're for example, our kids watch YouTube Kids, right?
Yes.
I want to make sure that I know what they're watching. Yeah.
Opening gifts. Toys.
There's some soy toy family. The SOTY or something, any family. And so in this one episode, you can see their house and it's just a normal house, nothing crazy. And then like subsequent episodes, they're in this beautiful mansion. Like, and I go, yeah, they're making some good money, but Kristen goes, she's like, it's all rented. They rent those spaces. They don't own that.
But they're smoking and mirroring just like the government smokes and mirrors, right? But if you ask like kids or teenagers now, bet you 1 in 5 say they want to be a YouTube streamer. Not a financial advisor, not a lawyer, not a doctor, maybe an athlete in there, YouTube streamer. Probably 20 to 40% of the kids saying that now. And it's just that, don't get me wrong, some of those streamers are dynamite and they're making a lot of money. They're putting a lot of effort and time into all that stuff. I mean, look at Dude Perfect. Look at Mr. Beast. Look at those guys out there like that. What do you think my kid watches? He doesn't watch Scooby-Doo anymore. He's watching Dude Perfect, who are making crazy-ass trick shots after doing 100 takes on it before they get it in, and are amazed by it. And that's almost like an arts degree, right? Because they're learning how to work the software and all that stuff. So it's crazy.
Yeah, when I say arts degree, what I mean is, like, when I went, we finished high school, there was almost a stigma if you didn't go to university.
Yeah, still is.
What's the matter with you? Why aren't you going to university? And I think as a society, we got to shift that, right? Because I raised my kids to try to chase what's going to make them happy. Right?
It's funny you say that, because whenever we have our family friends gather around and all that, I'm always the one says, I really don't give a shit if he goes to university or not.
Yeah.
I would like both my boys, and I'm very open about it, to get into business with dad, what I do, either building or real estate, right? And helping them out that, because I'm going to be able to groom them and spend more time with them, right? But when the families I talk to, they look at me like I'm speaking a different language from another planet, because how could you not put your kid in university or college? And I say, well, how many kids that go to university and get a degree or a college degree or university degree? To get a really good job, you have to go to law school after, or med school, or whatever you want to do, or take another course after that, right? If they want to do that. And I can't dissuade my sons from doing that if they want to do it. But I realize I don't have a university or college degree. You know, I'm like, I'm like four credits away from a college degree. Do I want to go back and finish it?
No
desire to whatsoever. No desire to whatsoever. I can impact society way more doing what I'm doing, and trying to show my sons there's a different way to do it. But when it comes down to it, no matter what you do, it's going to be your work ethic and your customer service. You could have a great work ethic and terrible customer service. You're not going to make it.
No.
You can have great customer service and a terrible work ethic, you know, which you're going to go both ways, but you're not going to make it. But now when you go to this is what drives me nuts. Now go to Tim Hortons, right? I'm going to meet clients at 1:30 today. I usually, anybody want a coffee, whatever, I pick it up on the way there just for nice customer service and all that.
Sure.
And then I'll be polite when I order it. And then when I'm done, I'll get the coffee or tea and I'll just say, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, they're just talking, so they're completely ignoring me. Don't give a shit. Right. And my wife wants our son to go to Tim Hortons to learn how to work like a dog in those things. And I think they're not working like a dog. And I don't want them to go into a fast food restaurant, because I just think it's a terrible experience. It's great. You work hard, blah, 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 blah. I don't like the grease and all that stuff on his face and all that. But I'm thinking, where I cut my teeth in customer service, which essentially what real estate is at its heart, is customer service on big assets, right?
Yep.
Now I've extended my knowledge base, which helps my career and connections and stuff like that. But essentially a real estate agent, and you know, even what the three of you guys do too, you have to have top customer service to excel at.
You gotta have sales.
When I first grew up, I worked at Blockbuster Video. I crushed it as much as you can in a retail job.
Yeah.
But it was learning how to deal with people and learn how to deal with, you know, conflict and stuff like that. Then I went to Future Shop after that, which was a commission-based one, which was different. And commission-based is not for everyone. And essentially, we're all kind of commission-based here, all four of us, more or less, right? Because we're going to eat, you know, what we serve, more or less, right? And we don't get repeat business unless we excel at it, right? No one's going to refer you of your shit.
Yep.
It's bottom line, just like trades and all that stuff.
Yep.
Right? So if I had to revamp schooling and all that, right now, I think the biggest dog shit thing about our economy, our industry, is the customer service is so balls right now in almost every aspect of stuff you go to. When you go to a store, a music store to buy something for my kid. Walked around in there for about 15 minutes. Not a single person even approached me. Me and my wife.
When I worked at Future Shop, don't care anymore, right?
No, they just don't care at all. They don't give a shit right now. And that's the problem I have with a lot of the government workers in municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
There's no incentive for them to get that contract done or to get that permit in or anything like that. They don't care. They get paid the same amount.
Collect my paycheck anyway, sir.
And that's the reason that I went into real estate, is that if I work my ass off, I'll be compensated more. And what drives me nuts is if I had a Lexus for a while, loved it. And I got some slack from my friends. Ooh, you know, Lexus. Or I pull up to a meeting and another realtor be there with his clients and he'd have a BMW and he'd have a Lexus. And honestly, I could care less what I drive. It's marketing, right? It's just marketing. If you're a realtor,
it's going to get you there regardlessly, right?
if you show up in a neon for a real estate appointment, you probably lost the client, unfortunately. Yeah. And that's a fact of it, right?
Yeah.
If you're a lawyer and you show up in an appointment, and you've got like a 1992 Chevette, you're probably not going to get that. You're not going to get that. It's an unfortunate part of it.
But true story, Jeff. I used to drive a beater vehicle, and
you'll get
the CAO from the city. The CAO from the city of Timmins, who love him, Joe Torlone, he was a beauty of a man. He's, you know, haven't talked to him in a bit, but regardless, he looked at me and said, "You've been representing us for 10 years and you're driving that piece of shit." Right?
Well, but, and at least he's candid enough to talk to you. But yes, like, yes, if you're a realtor and they're interviewing four realtors, they watch everybody, what they pull up to your house to talk to them.
Yeah.
Shit, his car is probably not going to. And it's an unfortunate thing, right? It's a stigma attached to it. And yeah, probably the same for all four of us right here, right? So it's
100%.
If you have the wrong one, right? So it's just customer service is just so poor lately that I've found, like going to Tim Hortons, going to, I won't even say the music store because I don't want to besmirch any local businesses or anything like that. Sure. Even when you're dealing with trades right now, to be honest, how many times have you seen on Facebook is that I'm looking for a concrete guy or I'm looking for a landscaper and I've called seven people, no one's called me back. How many times have you seen that? Yeah. No, it wasn't.
Sorry, Trev, we cut you off. You had something to say there and we went on a rant there.
Honestly, I can't even. Oh, the only one thing that I was going to say is a number of years back, you know, being connected to some trades professionals, I tried to get a trade. Not only is apprenticeship reform required, another huge problem in getting an apprenticeship, unions.
Yeah.
100%. Honest to God, just the whole, you know, you need a company to sponsor you and all of this, like it's the whole cart before the horse scenario when you're trying to get an apprenticeship, but it's also a union that's preventing and interfering with that. What do you do? You do nothing.
Yep.
Like, and when I say like tried to, my family is very, very closely connected to some top executives, part of a large company locally here, of trades professionals. Nothing could happen.
Yeah, now, I agree, though. Director complete and reform for trades needs to be done.
But where does the reform come from, right? Yeah, the reform's got to come, in my opinion, from the schools. Implement more co-op programs, right? So part of the schooling is...
That's actually not it. What it was something that we hit on initially. So it does start with the schools, but it starts with the provincial government, because the provincial government only allows one-on-one. So like one master electrician. Okay, a buddy of mine, a friend of the show, watches the show all the time. Rick Young, Young Electric, and he is a master electrician. He owns his own corporation. Because he's a master electrician, he's incorporated. He can hire apprentices and his own employees. In order for him to get to, for you to become a journeyman and then an apprentice, or apprentice and then a journeyman, he can only hire, he can only do one for one. And he goes, "I'm a master electrician. Why can't I take on two or three apprentices?" And his full-on journeyman can only do one for one. So all you're doing, So all you're doing is you're just replacing yourself. Yeah. You're not expanding the base.
Yeah.
So if we know that like the average age of carpenters, electricians, and plumbers specifically is around 60, 62, okay? We know that within the next 5 to 10 years, that all these guys are gone, because you also have to remember too, it's hard on their body. They can't do something, like they can do management, but they can't do what they used to do because it's very hard on their body.
I couldn't do it at 47. I couldn't do that at 47, what they do.
Right? I put DAP on two of my bathroom baseboards there, and my legs hurt for 2 days, and I'm in pretty good shape, right? Like,
that's right. So Rick was saying to me, he's like, you're only replacing yourself. So politicians need to open up the spaces of apprentices and allow journeymen and full-fledged master electricians, master plumbers, master carpenters to be able to take on more than just a one-on-one apprentice.
I think every 5 years you're a master apprentice or master electrician or a tradesperson, you should be able to add another
person.
So if you've done it for 20 years, 4. 25 years, 5. You know, like that.
So that might be a little impossible to do, but my logic is in a 5-year apprenticeship, year one, okay, I've got one guy and that guy requires a lot of my time as a master, but year two, the first guy is now in year two. They don't need as much time.
But what does it matter if there's two people watching you or one?
Well, because it's not that they're watching you, right? You're physically, you've got the guys, you know, from an electrician's perspective, you have the guys laying the conduit, you have the guys pulling wire, you have the guys doing all of this, right? So,
but there's a way that you can easily do it where you pull wire this day, fucking excuse my language, but you know what I mean? The next day you're hooking up the box or whatever.
Well, and they could train the masters in order how to train multiple people too. Like they could implement it from that. And then
I don't understand it very well, right?
A rebate back from the government to the masters in order to compensate them for the extra time. It just, you're right. It's got to be completely reformed. But like Dan, for example, could easily have four or five apprentices and teach them all at the same time. Because he does. He teaches them anyways.
Yeah, but Dan's very good, though, too, Jeff. Right?
But then Dan's got Simon below him, and Simon's also there to do it, who's like in his fourth year.
Yeah.
And he can train them at the same. So it's a group of people working together, being trained on it. Really comes down to hours. And then they have 2 months a year in school. So there's also theory on that stuff, but they're making money while they're learning.
But there's also, when you're not signed up as an apprentice, you're making a lower rate of pay. You can't carry all of those hours over. Right? That's not an entitlement. You can only carry over a small percentage. So if Simon is training these guys, but Dan's the only master carpenter, then he's got Simon underneath him. How does he get anybody else to get their hours that they need to be able to progress them down the line?
But I could teach all three of you something right now at the same time, and you could all learn.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm not
saying I don't have to be one of one say, guys, you got to leave. I'm teaching so-and-so. I can talk to all three of you about the Leafs are going to win the cup this year.
But now the difficulty with that, Jeff, is again, you're a very capable person and you're going to communicate that as a capable individual. You got to bring it down to the lowest common denominator, and the shitty electricians out there just having put in their time, they don't have the capability after 10 years or 15 years to be able to watch three people, and they're going to be able to do it. And they're going to try.
And then you implement testing, right? So not just pass your theory, your in class, and not just get your hours. Then you get tested at the end of it.
Yeah.
And if you're not capable, you don't pass. Because I could lie and be a master and say that he's an apprentice. There and say, hey, I write off your hours. Yeah. Still testing.
We don't have accountability for anything, Jeff. That's one word in our English vocabulary in the country that we live in. From the top to the bottom, there's no accountability.
And there's a lot of no recourse either is the problem.
Absolutely. Accountability. Where's the accountability for the government with the money that they spend of ours?
It's not even the money they spend. The only
accountability is the next election.
That's it.
Yeah. It goes liberals who spend. And then they got to get out because the tax is high. And then conservatives cut. Well, they're cutting too much. Then we got to go back to liberals. Boom, 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 boom.
Always cyclical. Always cyclical. And that's why.
Although it's at the ballot box that we get to make the decision, it also doesn't correct the bloat, right? The people that aren't elected officials, they still exist. They won't go away. They don't get terminated, right? Why? Like, you know, Curry and I have talked about this before. One of the reasons for the city of St. Catharines going up by 10.5% is they're hiring more employees.
Yeah.
Right.
So their efficiencies are terrible.
So, apparently they have too much work, not enough people to do it. Why isn't City Hall auditing? They should be auditing everybody's capabilities with work.
Yeah. What do you and their performance?
Because in the performance and everything. Private sector, you'll get fired. Fuck around and get fired.
Fuck around, find out. Have you seen the new thing with AI that they have on Starbucks employees that they're trying now?
No.
They actually have cameras watching, and it counts how many times they've served clients and their efficiencies for it. It's neat. It was on YouTube and all that. So it's literally got, okay, he's served like 27 coffees in that 1 hour or 15, and they're showing all their employees right there. Like the AI is going to be crazy.
Now you blow that up, and
that's going too far though, right?
No, but I mean, the difficulty
just said you want accountability and you want to be able to measure.
I want accountability, but people generally don't want to be accountable. Like when I grew up in Timminson in different circumstances, and it was a completely different world, but normally speaking, our clerks had a higher threshold in terms of what the expectation is out of them.
Compared to the average clerk, another firm or whatever.
Yeah. Now
you pay them accordingly.
No,
You didn't pay them accordingly?
No, I mean, it wasn't
set at a higher standard.
Well, they're probably paying the same as another firm, but they're doing more.
I had no point of reference relative to when I came down south.
Okay.
You just had a high standard of what you require.
100%, right? And I just followed along with, I bought into the business, right? So I kind of bought in, and there was one girl that was exceptionally, Nancy, exceptional talent in terms of a clerk. And she was my head clerk. And I just, you know what I mean? Whatever I can push her way financially to kind of keep her happy is what I did, right? Not even keep her happy, to keep me happy, right? Because I mean, I wanted to keep her happy. But again, it was a smaller sector. Those people didn't have the competition, right? Like, so they couldn't just walk down the street and get another law clerk job because there wasn't that many law offices, right? So it was a different environment, and they were very happy to have the job and what they were getting paid.
Well, right? And you're instilling an amazing work ethic into them too, right? So you're kind of setting them up for the rest of their life by having a high demand for them. When you don't demand a lot from people, they don't achieve much, right?
100%. So people, most of the times, are only going to do as much as they have to do.
Yeah.
Right. But now we live in a society where if you don't, they're going to leave and they're going to go across the street and get a job. You know what I mean? Like, I think we've lost, not all people, like we've got fabulous clerks that we work with. Right. But you see it. There have been a couple that have rolled through, and there's no loyalty there. Right. No matter how good you're trying to be with them, there's a shift in society. And I mean, I moved from the north to the south. So there's a little bit, you know, there's some inherent differences there. Right.
And I think there's a lot of burnout from COVID and all that. And there's a lot of malaise that people kind of live in right now. Right. Where that exceeding expectations is becoming harder and harder to come by.
Yeah,
you know, you can and all that, but it's exhausting. I think people honestly are saying, I don't need to push myself that anymore because it's stressing me out. I think that's part of it right there too, right? But you want to exceed expectations, you'll get ahead.
Yeah, but there's
I firmly believe that.
The accountability piece, Jeff, right? Like, I mean, it's like our clerks nowadays can't do the volume that my clerks did in Timmins because of all the bullshit that's involved in the files.
Yeah.
You know how it is. Every transaction that you touch nowadays, somebody in that process is a donkey and creates a headache clerks.
Like, did you hear from your fellow lawyer that closed one of my deals last Friday? Did he talk to you at all about it?
No.
I won't mention the names or anything like that, but had a closing. Unfortunately, it was on a Friday. And if any realtors are watching this, do your lawyer a favor and close on a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday if you can. Don't do it on a Friday. Don't do it on Monday, right? It's just a nightmare. And I realize that.
Or a Tuesday out of a long weekend.
Yeah, whatever. But do it in the middle of the week if you can, because it's just not as busy. But we had a house closing, and the lawyer at your firm, and it wasn't my choice, I tried to get it to you guys all the time, had called 10 times, faxed, emailed, everything, couldn't get a response, couldn't even leave a message for the other lawyer. They had a requisition about 2 weeks earlier.
So I did hear about this.
Then your fellow lawyer called me, and first I heard about it was 4:15. So I jump on the phone right away. I'm calling the other agent who's from GTA, right? Mm-hmm. Not all GTA agents are lawyers. I don't disparage them all. It's happened a lot more lately. What's going on? Okay, let me get on the phone. Call back. He's been into his lawyer's office and signed all the papers and handed a big check. Great. Well, you still got to close. Yeah. Where's the money? So 4:35 or 4:40, the money all of a sudden appears in the account out of nowhere, but you still need closing documents to close, or you can't register until it's after 5 o'clock. You're done.
Done.
Right?
So office closes.
Yeah. So 4:58, the paperwork comes in. The other lawyer's like, we can't close now. There's no time. We've been begging you all day to call us back. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
And so writes a big letter. We're unable to close. We'll close first thing in the morning on Monday.
Yep.
And wrote a kind of
snide.
Yeah, you could say that politely, but protected the steps of what happened that day, you know, to put it on paper to protect it all. And the other lawyer gets back and says, this is disgusting, and I'm going to take your client to small claims court and all that. And really, it was like, pick up the damn phone.
Exactly.
Have a voicemail that works. Reply.
But that's the accountability piece, right? So then now you've got
But it's also on the clerks on the other behalf too, because that clerk who's closing should have contact with your guy's clerk and just communicate.
But that's what I'm saying, right? Like, I can't have the same expectation out of my clerks nowadays relative to when I started my my career, which is crazy, right? And I think the biggest reason for that is that lack of accountability that a lot of people carry with themselves nowadays. And it's almost always one piece, the insurance broker or the mortgage broker or the other lawyer, the other client. Like, you know, out of dealing with 8 or 10 people on one transaction, there's almost always a donkey that makes everybody else's job that much more difficult.
Oh, I needed insurance to close?
Yeah. We told you that in the introductory email 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it happens.
It's so friggin' frustrating.
Well, and there's mortgage guys on the other side too sometimes that are dropping the ball, right? Not even having everything.
Absolutely.
Appraisal's not done. Appraisal's done like 3 days before. Like,
we all experience
what's going on.
And that's why I'm saying, in terms of my expectations out of my clerks had to change.
Yeah.
It had to change based on the bullshit that they're dealing with now. Right. And that's not fair, because initially I came down with the mentality being like, well, why aren't you guys as productive of what I'm accustomed to? Right.
And well, I think it's great though, because your high expectations are going to increase their skill set, which really in turn should increase their pay, regardless if they work with you or someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're doing a favor. High expectations should be the expectation on anybody.
For sure. But just say, for instance, Jeff, if my clerks used to do 25 deals.
And now they're doing 60.
No, one clerk, say, it was up north was doing 25. Now I can only really expect her to do 15 to 20, because in order to get the 15 to 20, she's probably committing as much, if not more, time.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying.
To get it done, right? Because you're jumping through more hoops or dealing with more idiots, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so frustrating, because our society, I guess, generally from what I'm seeing, because of that weak link, has become less productive.
Yeah. It's weird, because my expectations on most files are I'm going to have to pick up some slack here, and I don't care. I'll have to get it done, but it is frustrating.
But when
I expect it now.
When you started, though, was it?
No, I was probably the weak link when I started.
Well, I mean, we all were to a certain extent, right?
Well, but experience makes big changes for you. 100%. So if you've had, for example, like a basement where water's coming up from a drain and you've experienced before, first time you experience it, sky's falling.
100%.
Black mold in an attic on a deal that I have, sky's falling, right? Yep. But now it's like, no, I've been there, here, this is what we do, I've been there.
Yep. Yep.
That's the difference. And experience is, you can't get it without time. Yep. You just can't get it without time, right? And that's the unfortunate thing. That's part of the business.
Or a good system where you're coming up working together with somebody who has had that experience.
Well, and that's where mentorship, I think, is huge.
Correct.
Unfortunately, in my industry, it's very hard to find a good mentor, because the inconvenience of being a mentor for most people outweighs the advantage of trying to help someone become, you know, a big producer. Where you see in my industry, the best mentors are for family. Yeah. So if I get my sons in there, I'm going to mentor the shit 100%. Out of them, right?
100%.
Just because it's me helping a family member excel. Where,
like,
do
me
I want
John,
to help a
right?
competition excel and become my competition sometimes?
Yeah.
You might want to do that. The mentorship, I think, in real estate, the way they do an apprenticeship for trades, at least half the time should be a mentor. You should be required 2 to 3 years to mentor under a real estate agent before you be released into the wild.
No, you can have I disagree with you.
Well, the broker's there for that too.
You mentor 2 to 3 years, and then after that, you got to give another 2 to 3 years under that person as well. After they've given you their time, to train you, pay it forward.
I think if you did that, it would increase the quality of real estate out there, and that's kind of the brokerage's duty to train that.
Yeah,
but they make it incumbent on the realtor, for example. If you want it, you figure it out, kind of, right? You train, you got to do that. But there's nothing more valuable than a mentorship, like with you and John, right? You've mentored him to where he is right now.
He'd say
and without that, he well, but without that, he probably wouldn't be the lawyer he is today. right? And if I get an opportunity, I've taken a couple shots at mentoring before and all that. And if they don't have the same work drive, work ethic that you do, how do you mentor them? You can't instill that on, right? Either you want or you don't in this business.
100%.
You want to make money in real estate? Work.
Yep.
How do you work? Talk to people.
Most industries. Most industries, right? Work.
But the mentorship thing, I think, is so crucial to becoming successful. Because if you have a great mentor, you'll probably flourish in your career. If you don't, you'll probably be out of it.
Could flourish, but you might not be good.
For me, I honestly, I didn't flourish for the first 10 years of my career. This October 7th, I'll be 20 years in real estate. 20 years. First 10 years, couldn't find the right mentor, couldn't find the right training, and I trialed and erred forever. Screwed up so many things. And unfortunately, I look back and it's like probably all you guys in your career, you look back,
100%.
Made mistakes when you did it and all that stuff, right? And gave the wrong advice or whatever. But now I can guide that. And I love talking to young agents that call me every once in a while to do that. But it's tough because you're on the phone for an hour a day talking to these guys, trying to help them. And it takes away from your own business, right? There's no compensation for being a mentor. Unfortunately, you can in real estate, you're taking some of their cut. I don't like that. But I look forward to being able to mentor both my boys in either part of the business I do, if they choose to.
But that's why I was saying, Jeff, don't take the cut off them when you're mentoring them for 2 to 3 years, but then, you know, maybe have them work under you for another 2 years and then you get some payback. You know what I mean?
Well, that's part of the problem. Like if you're a realtor and you're in the top 5% of the real estate industry and you're particular, you're making decent money. You're working your balls off. I'm not gonna lie, it's not easy money. Working really hard to do that, right? But to get paid $1,000 a quarter to mentor somebody, is it worth your time to do
that?
Not
a chance.
It's an inconvenience. There's no compensation for it.
Correct.
It doesn't, you know, and that's why they have these teams out there who are officially mentors with, you know, higher expectations, and they'll take 50% of their income. Do I think that's fair? I don't think that's fair either.
But I mean, realistically, we.
But they're getting a mentorship more or less, right?
Yeah. And I mean, but look at the amount of time that Brandon, Trevor, myself, you, like we donate, we coach, we're on Wise Guys. You know what I mean? None of us get paid for any of that.
It's peace of mind, you know. It's spiritual healing and stuff like that. It's giving back,
helping people out, right? And I think a lot of people have gone away from just friggin' helping one another out just for the sake of helping somebody out.
Yeah. Well, karma, sometimes you put it out there, it comes back to you too, right? And you shouldn't do it for that reason, but it is. But it's also tough because when you have your own family too, you want to spend your time with them as much as you can too, right?
I'm not saying you have to donate all of your time, but you know, if everybody donated a little, everybody knows, everybody, look, you got the same people coaching that are volunteering at the not-for-profit agencies, etc., right? Like, you know, there's 20% of the population that does this crap. You know, if maybe 50% of the population did, it'd be a little bit less of a load.
I coach my boys.
Yeah.
Well, I coach Ryder, but the whole team, I love it. I love being the coach.
Absolutely.
I think it's one of the best experiences. And it's the most unthankful thing, too, because you're getting yelled at by other parents or sitting on the sides and all that. Here's the whistle. Here's the whistle. You could show up here an hour before every game and stay an hour after to clean up and all that.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. But I love it. Like we're having our baseball party tomorrow with all the kids coming over.
That's
and they're all kids that are going to high school right now. The first year in high school. I can't wait to talk to them all.
Yep.
So I was with them 4 days a week in the summer and I haven't seen them since. Right. So
yeah, I've been lucky. Most of my parents have been.
Trevor, have you coached yet at all? Or I know Bond does. You coached like two things, right? Yep.
Yeah.
Curry, are you going to look to coach when your kids get a little older?
I don't know.
Maybe soccer or something if they get into soccer. No.
They're already into soccer. I just don't have I right now don't have the time to.
Well, you do a lot of time on the philanthropy side.
Curry's having conversations about being broken down in the winter in the car.
Yes.
Yeah.
Going on. And, not for the podcast, Trevor.
Well, we did promise that a couple of the ladies from last night that may come up at our NBG meeting. So we don't have to get into full details.
I need to hear this story. I don't know this story. Broken down in the car.
We have the conversation offline, but Chaz was part of this conversation as well. It was quite comical.
If he was ever in a pinch, he would be extra friendly. Is really what it.
One other thing that I want to point out, Bond. Obviously, last night you remember Brandon's hairdo.
Yeah, well, looks like he's got a new
that's
cut.
A fresh
G.
cut, apparently.
Yeah.
It's fresh. Yesterday
just wasn't good enough.
Just for the episode. There.
Just for the episode. Yeah.
Nice.
There we go, and he'll be back at his barber or hairdresser.
Well, nobody saw. I also got a new haircut. I just didn't do it as skin tight as Curry over there.
Yours does look very nice as well, Jeff.
He's got the UFC. I didn't quite go that way because I got too many little bumps and shit on there. It looks a little.
He's got the full hawk going almost there.
Right, he's almost full hawk there. He almost got the. Does it go all the way to the back too? You got the
point. Yeah, still shaved.
That's what all the kids got now. They got the mullet going right down the back. Right, it's almost like
mohawk.
The Paul guy, Logan Paul, and what's his brother's name?
Jake Paul.
Jake Paul. Yeah, they all got that haircut now. All the young kids.
Before we end, I got to give a shout out to my man Strickland, knocking the shit out of Adesanya, UFC.
Oh yeah, did you see the big merger too?
No.
The people who own UFC bought WWE. It's under one.
Oh, I heard so that. Vince, that was in the works.
Vince McMahon is no longer the sole controlling person. I'm a big WWE, UFC, sports, economics. I love that. I could talk it until I'm blue in the face. But that just happened.
That's crazy.
They bought it for like billions and billions of dollars.
That's crazy.
So now Dana White's not in control. He's the CEO of that division.
Okay.
But he doesn't have final say on UFC, so they might – because the big debate in UFC is they don't pay the fighters enough, right? And I don't know if you saw The Rock bought the one guy a house. Did you see that ever?
No.
The Rock had one guy who had like $7 in his pocket. And he was like a UFC fighter training, living in a car and all that. And he won his match. And he won like a $10,000 kind of bonus, whatever. And The Rock was so touched by it, he bought him a house.
Wow.
It's crazy. And then Dana White went on record and said, well, if I had The Rock's money, I'd buy everybody else. I think Dana White's doing all right.
He doesn't have The Rock's money.
Well,
I'm
I think
pretty
the Rock's
sure Dana White's
going to
eat
right
where he wants.
Dana
steak.
White's doing okay. Yeah.
Well, The Rock owns that. What's that tequila brand he owns? Makes some big bucks.
Nah, I mean, he's done well. He's a marketing genius, right? Like, you know.
Well, which is crazy.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Heard it with the eyebrow.
The Rocky Maivia.
Well, you ever watch the show The Young Rock? It's the story of him.
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's great. It was like three seasons. I'm a WWE geek, though. So.
Well, I heard Triple H and Stephanie McMahon were pretty close to being at the helm of WWE.
They were going to be. Triple H is in creative control right now. Stephanie McMahon stepped back because I think there's family issues there.
Okay.
And Vince has the big lawsuit against him for being a womanizer.
Womanizer.
Yeah, that's the big thing now.
Crazy.
Yep. All right. Well, we better wrap it up. So, Bondo, you want to take us out?
Help us help you stay informed.
Ciao.
Thanks, everybody.
Emily Roger, and I host a leadership show called The Boiling Point with my co-host, Dave Vail. Together, we sit down with trailblazing entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and movement makers who are driving meaningful change in our world. The show is all about exploring the lives and perspectives of leaders who are making a difference. Join us for insightful conversations that challenge the status quo, spark new ideas, and inspire you to take action. Find us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or at BoilingPointPodcast.com.
Do, Did, Will, the Story of People podcast is now available on the Crier Media Network. The first 5 episodes are here and feature some incredible guests that fit into one or all 3 of those categories. Ready? Tara Sloan from the San Jose Sharks, Undercurrent podcast at NBC Sports. Marianne Iveson from Iveson Voice and the Let's Take This Outside podcast to talk about the world of outdoors as well as voiceover land. Ariana Hunsicker, future Canadian Paralympic swimmer, already winning tons of awards for this country. Scott McGregor from the Hot Wallet podcast to dumb down the world of crypto, Bitcoin, and NFTs so you don't have to. And Jackie Holowaty from Climate Pledge Arena in Seattle, Washington, the first net zero carbon certified arena on the planet. Wherever you get your pods, wherever you watch your pods, and on the Crier Media Network.
produced by Cryer Media and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.